He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now bands from Aram had gone out and taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of this leprosy." Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means go," the king of Aram replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter I am sending my servant Naaman, so that you may cure him of his leprosy." As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me." When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message: "Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger to him to say, "Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed." But Naaman went away angry and said, "I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of his Lord, his God, wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than any of the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleaned?" So he turned off and went in a rage. Naaman's servants went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleaned?" So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. The second reading is from Mark chapters 1, verses 40 to 45. Now a man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Filled with compassion, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said, "be clean." Immediately the leprosy left him and he was cured. Jesus sent him away at once with a strong warning, "See that you don't tell this to anyone. But go, show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing, as a testimony to them." Instead, he went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. As a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly, but stayed outside in lonely places. Yet the people still came to him from everywhere.
So, there's a lot in those two readings about leprosy. So I want to just give you a bit of background to leprosy as it is in the Bible. And the first thing to say is that leprosy in the Bible is not the disease that we call leprosy today. Leprosy today is a disease called, also known as Hansen's disease. And I'm quite certain that leprosy in the Bible is not that disease, because in Alexandrina, I can't remember the year, it was BC sometime, a number of scholars gathered together to translate the Old Testament into Greek, and that became known as the Septuagint, this Greek version of the Old Testament, so out of Hebrew and into Greek. And as they were translating, they came across in Leviticus where there are instructions for the cleansing of infectious skin diseases. And the word that they used there in the Greek translation was lepra, which is where we get our word leprosy from. But they didn't use another word, which was a word for that disease that we know now as Hansen's disease. In ancient Greek culture, that disease was known, and it was called elephantiasis. So there was a completely different word. So if it was leprosy as we call things leprosy today, that would have been the word they chose. But they use this other word, lepra, which is really a kind of a catch-all phrase for a number of disfiguring and possibly contagious skin diseases, sort of unknown origins. It might include things like psoriasis or eczema, but it could also include scabies or other diseases that might be infectious. In the Old Testament, there's a distinction made between some skin diseases that weren't infectious and that person was clean, able to be a regular, normal part of the community, and some diseases that were infectious. And so the priest had that role of sorting out which was which. I'm glad that didn't carry on into current times, because I'm a little bit squeamish. And those diseases could get better. So there was a process that is referred to in Mark's gospel, where when you believed you were healed, you could go to the priest. The priest would look and confirm, yes, it's no longer infectious, it's no longer a problem. And then you'd go and you'd offer a sacrifice at the altar, at the temple, as a, you know, I guess, a kind of thanksgiving. And it was a sign to the whole community that, yes, you were now clean and able to take part in life in the community again. So it's that kind of disease. The second thing, and this is something kind of new, is that the picture of lepers in the ancient world, if you've seen Ben-Hur or The Robe or any of those kind of epic biopics about Jesus even, lepers tend to be right outside the community, don't they? Living in caves, quite poor, calling out unclean, unclean, nobody going near them. And a man whose first name I can't remember, it might be Robert, but his surname is Shinal. He's a surgeon and a biblical scholar. I found an article of his in the Journal of Biblical Literature about leprosy at the time of Jesus. And all the scholarship shows, all the historical records show that lepers weren't particularly excluded from the community. And in fact, we get that a little bit even in the account about Naaman, don't we? Because he is the commander of the king's army. So he's a very significant person in Aram, or Syria, as it would be known today. And also he was very wealthy. When he goes to see Elisha, goes to Israel to get healed, he takes 10,000 talents of silver. That's a lot of money. And 6,000 shekels of gold. Again, that's very wealthy. And 10 sets of garments. Can you believe that? That's a bit, that strikes us as a bit, huh? I was reading today in the paper that there's a clothing company in China that is copying designs off, you know, and they're producing 2,000 new lines of clothing a day. 7,000 a day, sorry. And which I find just staggering. And they're selling clothes like for $7 for a pair of jeans and so on. So we're really, now, our clothing may not have been that cheap, but we're really used to having clothing readily available and quite cheap. But in the ancient world, clothing, we've had the Industrial Revolution, which has enabled cotton mills and the processing of large amounts of fibre. In the ancient world, that didn't exist. Making fabric was complicated. If you want to see a really great series, it's called The Worst Jobs in History. And guy from, what's his name, Tony Robinson? Yeah, he kind of presents it. And I think the worst job was a job called the fuller. So the fuller was basically the person who enabled fabrics to be bleached. So fabrics would be woven, and then the fuller's job, first job, was to go to the local stables and collect horse urine. That's not a job I care to think about how you do that. Second job was then he had to put it into vats and let it ferment. And then he had to put when it was nicely fermented, he had to put the coarse woven fabric into the vats and let it work on it for a while. And then he had to climb in and tread on it to soften it all, to soften the fibres. I think that may well be the worst job in history. But it was complex. They have really good... Most people, working people, would have probably had one set of clothes, and if they were lucky, they'd have a special set of clothes for things like weddings or something like that. But most people just had one set of clothes. In the Old Testament, there's a law that if you are poor, if you give a loan to a poor person and you take his cloak as collateral, every day you have to return to him at night so that he's got something warm to sleep with. Your clothing was also your bedding. That's quite interesting, isn't it? So 10 sets of garments, wow, that's a great gift. That's expensive in the ancient world. So anyway, all that to say that Naaman wasn't an outcast, you know, begging for crumbs in a cave. He was in a good position in the king's army and he had significant wealth. So having said all that and sort of just pulling back from that picture of abject poverty and exclusion, which I think is overdrawn. Scholars think that maybe it was overdrawn as a kind of a contrast, to kind of highlight a contrast between Christians and Jews. There's a possibility of that. But anyway, what is true is that these infectious skin diseases were noticeable. And so even though there may not have been the kind of social exclusion that we picture, there was some degree of exclusion, some degree in which people with leprosy would have felt the difference and the distance from full acceptance by the wider community. And there were certainly some aspects of life that saw lepers excluded. So worship in Israel's temple was excluded. If you had leprosy, there's no way known you could be there. Probably no parents wanted their daughter to marry a leper. So in a situation of arranged marriage, very often lepers were unable to be married. Naaman does have a wife. We hear about her in the reading. Quite likely lepers may have not often been invited to social events. So there's some difficulty with leprosy. And of course, it's an illness. So it just has its physical impact too. Otherwise, there'd be nobody asking for healing from leprosy, would there? If there was nothing wrong about it, no impact to it, nobody would be asking to be healed. It'd just be like saying, well, I've got ears. Now, the leper who went to Jesus, kneeling before him, it says he implored him. That's a really strong word. It was really important to him that he be healed from his leprosy. And of course, for Naaman, it seems important enough to make a journey from Damascus to little hick Israel to find some prophet that a servant girl's talked about, like, and also with a great gift, like it matters to him that he would be healed. So that's just sort of, I'm just trying to cut away some things we might think. And just now to have a quick look at these readings from Kings and Mark. And the first thing, the most important thing, I just love the beginning of that reading in Mark's Gospel. Man with leprosy came to him, imploring him, and kneeling, said to him, if you will, if you're willing, you can make me clean. And Jesus says, I do will. I am willing. Be clean. I just love that, don't you? Like, here's a man with something that really matters to him, a help that he really needs. And Jesus has mercy on him. Now, Jesus, we know, is the face of God to us. He who has seen me has seen the Father, he says. And so what we see in Jesus we know to be true of God. And so we know this, I know this, but it's just so good to say it and think it again and again, isn't it? Our God is a God who delights to show mercy. He doesn't see our burdens, our failures, our needs, our desperations. He doesn't see them as a pain, as a trouble to him. He looks on us with mercy. Before we ask him, if you're willing, he has shown us, I am willing. I'm willing to come to you, to help you, to be your strength. So that's just the most beautiful thing from the passage, isn't it? You get that too. Actually, there's Naaman, king of the army, commander of the army. The king's in Damascus. He's there. He's got a wife, and his wife has a young Israelite servant girl. So quite likely, this girl has been taken captive in war. That may be how she's ended up in service in Naaman's household. It's hard to think of any other way that could have happened. And this young girl, she says to her mistress, Naaman's wife, she says, there's a prophet in Israel who could help. I find that particularly beautiful. Like, if you'd been taken captive and were servant in the army commander's household, would you be seeking to bless him? Which is really what she's doing, isn't it? There she is, but what I love most about it is she understands God. Like, there's help for you. I reckon that's beautiful. God can help you. What a thing to be able to tell people, God can help you. And that you can say that to anybody and it's true. And he's willing to. That's true too. Well, Jesus heals him with a word, a touch and a word. That's one thing that's really beautiful, isn't it? That Jesus, he sees this man and he has compassion for him. That's what Mark says. Moved with pity, he reached out his hand and touched him and said, be clean. So there's a great deal of empathy, compassion, pity, mercy in the heart of Jesus there. And he reaches out his hands and touches him. Now that would have been something that would have made people recoil. You wouldn't do that. That's a leper. That man has leprosy. Ugh. But Jesus is unfazed. That's what he does. He reaches out and he puts his hand on him. Well, that would be a really wonderful thing for that man. A friend has come to him and put his hand on him. Standing with him, being with him, loving him, having compassion for him. But more than that, also taking away from him what is his trouble. Mark doesn't tell us, but Matthew tells us in his gospel that when Jesus does these healings, he quotes the prophet Isaiah saying about Jesus, he took up our diseases and carried our infirmities. And so maybe that's what is happening here. Jesus is not just, he is empathetic, he's compassionate, but he's doing something. He is doing something by his word and by his touch. He's healing this man. It's really beautiful. Now, there is a lot of empathy in that act, and empathy is a really important thing, isn't it? Mind you, that's a fairly 20th century thing to say. Apparently, empathy as a word was hardly ever used until about the 1970s. It was a word that existed, but it was very rarely used. But since the 1970s, there's been an explosion in the use of the word empathy, hasn't there? And I think about that, and I think, well, I wonder why that is. Certainly, empathy is important. The ability to see where a person is and have some feeling of what their situation means for them. I think that's what empathy is. Sort of, it's like standing in their shoes or standing beside them and seeing the world as they see it and understanding their feeling from within. That's a very wonderful thing, and it's a great thing when somebody is empathetic with you, isn't it? But empathy alone wouldn't be enough for this man. There may well have been other empathetic people in his life. Now, in our age, we've confused empathy with mercy and may have even substituted empathy for mercy. So this feeling for the situation of another person is empathy, but mercy is actively helping to change the situation. That's what mercy is. Mercy is an act, not a feeling. God is merciful. That means he's always acting in mercy. Everything he does, he's acting in mercy. Now, in today's culture, the idea of trying to change a person's situation is starting to be thought of as a bit judgmental. People love empathy, but if you suggested a change, that's seen as possibly judgmental. We call it shaming. That happens today. And sometimes it feels like when you're trying to help someone, you're walking in a minefield, you don't know when the offence is going to come. And I think that's really sad, because what that means is that mercy is locked out of the equation. If you can't offer or do something that can help change the situation for the person, if you're only meant to say, that's great, we love you just like that, and that's just great. If that's it, there's no help. If a person's in a raging flood, going to the side of the river, saying deeply, I really feel for your situation, but you know, it's great that you've chosen to be there, and I fully support you in your decision, and I'm sorry it's not kind of working quite the way you, but it's sad, but you know, that's not mercy, is it? That mercy goes and gets a rope, ties it to a tree, ties it to yourself, and then you wade out into the water to help the person. That's what mercy is. Mercy does something. I reckon that's really good. And Jesus comes with mercy for the helpless. He sees this man and he puts his hand on him and he takes away his disease. It's always, mercy always has some cost or risk to the merciful. We talked today about slacktivism. You know, you can be concerned about causes by clicking likes. It's slacktivism. You don't actually have to do anything. At least the activists used to do something. Anyway, here's the wonderful thing though. Jesus comes with mercy for the helpless. Whatever it is that you feel helpless about, whether it's the social situation in which you're set, whether it's some deep sorrow that you can't overcome, whether it's some besetting sin, whether it's an illness, whatever it is, you can come to Jesus and he has mercy for you. The mercy may be surprising mercy, but he will do something. You can come to Jesus and find help to turn your situation around somehow. He will not drive you away. he will not express disinterest. That's beautiful. I think that's beautiful anyway. Second thing to note from this reading is that to receive mercy is to be humble. You can't receive mercy without humility. I'll come back to that thought in just a moment. But there's Naaman. He's gone off to Israel at the recommendation of that young servant girl. And the king has sent a letter with him. So he goes to see the king of Israel, this important person. He's come with chariots. Just by the way, the chariots were the tanks of the ancient world. Like, it could have looked like an invasion. He's come and he's asked to see the king and he's presented the king's letter. And what's the letter said? It said, when this letter reaches you, know that I've sent to you Naaman, my servant, that you may cure him of his leprosy. Full stop. And so the king reads it and he's thinking, oh, heck. How the heck am I meant to do that? And that's what he says. Am I God that you'd expect me to do that? And then he suspects that the whole thing is a ruse to begin a pretext for war between Aram and Israel. He's picking a quarrel with me. And you turn down my request for help, in marches the army. That's what he thinks. But Elisha, the prophet, who the girl knows about, he's heard where he is that this man has come, and he's heard about what the king said and how he's torn his clothes and kind of thrown up his hands in the air and wailed his misfortune that he ever had this happen to him. And Elisha sends this message, why have you torn your clothes? Let him come now to me that he may know there is a prophet in Israel. There's Elisha. There's the servant girl. She has more faith about God than the king does, doesn't she? She's a mighty person of faith. And so Naaman goes, says, with his horses and chariots, all of his wealth, and he arrives at the house of Elisha. I'm here and I've come for healing. Like, it's a power play. I've come with great gifts to the man who can heal me. There's not a lot of humility about that, is there? And he is so offended about what happens. So, you know, I'm here. No one comes to the door except finally they hear the kind of the pitter-patter of feet and the door opens wide or the gate opens and out comes not Elisha but a servant with a message like, look, go and wash in the river Jordan 7 times and be clean. See ya. I am Naaman, the magnificent. And you treat me like that? He says, surely Elisha should have come out, this mighty man of God, and invoked the name of his God and waved his hands over me. Whoosh, whoosh, be healed. Kind of seems a little bit like some healing services you go to me. He was expecting the show because he was important. And he doesn't get it. And he's furious and he storms off. And his servants have more wisdom than he does. They realise that Naaman's pride is robbing him of his healing. He can't be healed because he's proud. And they remind him that in Elisha's words there was a very wonderful promise. Wash and be healed. Wash and be clean. Very beautiful little promise there that And they say to him, look, if he'd said to you, you had to stand on your head for 8 hours and let the ants crawl over you and eat, you know, dead possum for a week and then you'll be healed, you probably would have done that because that would have been a show. That would have been something. But all he said is, in a way, receive. Receive God's cleansing. And so he submits to the word and goes and washes and becomes clean. It's beautiful. The story does go on and it involves Elisha's servant who himself has seen the possible prize and who's coveted the prize, all that wealth. But anyway, you can read about that later. Elisha himself doesn't covet it at all. Elisha's satisfied to give the word. Anyway, he's clean at the end. The leper, in contrast, isn't proud, is he, in Mark's gospel? The man with leprosy in Mark's gospel. He shows all the marks of humility. He comes and he implores, that is, he begs, and he falls down at Jesus' feet, entrusting himself to the will of Jesus, who then stretches out his hand and touches him and says, be clean, and he is. So there's pride and there's humility. You can't. Humility never takes long to talk about, does it? Humility is beautiful in its simplicity. Humility isn't saying, I'm not worth it, I'm a dreadful person. That's not humility. Remember, I think it's C.S. Lewis who says, humility isn't thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. It's actually thinking about, and humility in the face of mercy is to think about the merciful one and how merciful he is. It's not about desert or not desert. It's not about whether you're worth it or not worth it. It's about recognising here is somebody who is merciful. Mercy that is earned is not mercy. That's payment. It's just, you see, mercy can't be seen without humility. In a way, Naaman arrives expecting to buy healing, either through his great wealth or through his political power, his military power, and he has to just receive mercy, receive healing. Humility is the openness that desperation often creates, isn't it? Where you are at the end of yourself and you're at the end of whatever and you just know, I need help. And it enables you to see where help is. We can only receive God's mercy and forgiveness as a free gift. Only humility can do that. And this is true about the very basis of our Christian lives. Paul put it this way in Romans 3. There's no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We all need mercy. And all are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. None of our piety, none of our morality, none of our theology qualifies us for God's mercy. All true piety, all true morality, all true theology flows out from God's free, lavish, overflowing kindness in love. The religious mind thinks that we get through what we do. But faith sees that God gives before we act. Faith is humility in action. August Toplady wrote a hymn. I don't know what I think about the whole hymn, but I do like this verse. Nothing in my hand I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. Naked, come to thee for dress. Helpless, look to thee for grace. Foul, I to the fountain fly. Wash me, Saviour, or I die. I love that. And that's us. Now, the last thing that I want to tell just quickly is in 2 Kings, the young Israelite maidservant told her mistress, Naaman's wife, what she knew. There is a prophet in Israel who can help. In Mark, the healed leper can't keep the news of his healing to himself, even though Jesus has told him not to tell anybody. He goes out and tells everybody freely. He's just busting with the news of Jesus can help. Jesus helped me. And he was willing. He was willing. He showed me mercy. Now, the reason Jesus doesn't want him to tell is because at this point in his ministry, he's really wanting to be able to have time to proclaim and teach the matter of the kingdom. And with the news about the healings that have been going on right through Mark 1, we're at the end of that chapter now pretty well. Here we are. It's become like a travelling circus. Everywhere he goes, there's crowds crowding in, wanting his help one way or another. It's not that he resents that. In fact, what he's come for is mercy for the whole world. But it's not going to be a one-by-one, fix-everyone-up thing. He's got to do a deeper thing. That's what he's aiming for. But anyway. But what they both do is that they both know something about God that they can tell others. Oh, I reckon that's good, because that's like you and me. You don't have to be a great theologian to tell the gospel, do you? You just need to know what God has shown you in the face of Jesus. And you can tell people. I think, you know, you may have children or grandchildren or friends or neighbours. All of them, everybody needs mercy. Everybody does. And you've got this chance to say to them, I know a God who can help. And would you be okay? Would it be okay with you if I pray for God to help you? You could do that with them. You could do that separately. Whenever I ask people if they'd be happy for me to pray for them, I've never had anybody say no. I don't know if you have. It's quite possible. If you met a militant atheist. But even then, I reckon maybe they'd be wanting to test it out. That's just something like, that's a starting point, isn't it? For sharing what you know about God through Jesus. And you're really starting right at the centre. You're really saying, I know a God who is merciful. Maybe that'll start a conversation. But Jesus has called us out into the world, hasn't he, to make good news known. And so what we know, we can tell. And if you know that God has been merciful to you, you've got something really good to tell the world. Amen.